Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Conscious eating, that is making food choices that are good for you and the planet, can be a tricky proposition, especially in the era of COVID-19. Author Sophie Egan has written a new book about the topic pre-virus titled How to Be a Conscious Eater, Making Food Choices That Are Good for You, Others, and the Planet. Welcome to the show, Sophie Egan.
Thank you so much for having me.
How much of your advice still applies during what could be a months-long change of pace and change of access to food?
This question is honestly the one I'm thinking about 24/7 these days. The short answer is the vast majority of it still applies, in that it is meant to be an evergreen mental checklist that is asking yourself, how do I align my food choices with the things I care about, with my values? And I suggest that we ask, is this food good for me? Is it good for others? And is it good for the planet? And the way that we're thinking about what's good for us, who we're including in others, those things may have shifted. But the idea of having a shorthand, but also a holistic view of evaluating food choices, is still as relevant as ever, if not more so. And this is really what I'm thinking about, is corona conscious eating.
Are you worried at all that, given the crisis, that people will think it's just too much of a luxury to think this way about food?
You know, that was my concern at first, and it's been really interesting to watch the ways that eaters are responding. So I think maybe one of the first examples that comes to mind is reusability seems to be going out the door, right? We're all accustomed to bringing our reusable grocery bags. Now, here in Seattle, Washington, my grocery store no longer allows me to bring my reusable bags. Things like single-use plastics and the scourge of plastics have gained a lot of momentum culturally for phasing those out. But now they feel like maybe a safer choice. We're using lots and lots of single-use items, wipes and gloves, right?
Yeah.
But I think the long run momentum will still be there. And if anything, this is uniting us as a global community in some ways more than we ever have been in terms of our interdependence. So there's lots of interesting connections to addressing the climate crisis that will in the long term perhaps even be more likely for us to come together around through collective action. The idea that what I do affects how your health is through air pollution and so forth. And also the fact that small steps add up. So I'm heartened, actually, about the spirit of connectedness that's occurring, this idea of together apart. But definitely in the short term, we are, rightly so, more focused on things like just staying safe, food safety, immune systems, and our own well-being. And at the same time, though, I don't think it's a luxury for many folks to think about, what can I do for restaurants, for farmers, for the vulnerable, the 40 million Americans who are food insecure pre-virus.
Right.
That only is more relevant now. And in some ways, we're more conscientious about, for example, not wasting food.
Right, exactly. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about How to Be a Conscious Eater. That's the title of a new book by Sophie Egan. Sophie has a long resume, not enough time here to talk about it, but she's, is or was director of health, Sophie, health
was,
and sustainability.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I have a new update. I'm now the founder of Full Table Solutions, a consulting practice that accelerates solutions at the intersection of food, health, and climate. But for 5.5 years, I was the director of health and sustainability leadership for the Culinary Institute of America, and they remain a proud client of mine, and I'm happy to continue leading a really exciting network there of colleges and universities called the Menus of Change University Research Collaborative.
And you have a master's in public health too, right?
I do. That's right.
Yeah. And she also regularly contributes to the New York Times health section and has written for Eating Well, Time, The Washington Post, Bon Appetit, Wired, and many other publications. If you have a question or comment for Sophie about how to be a conscious eater, you know, obviously everything's tainted right now by the coronavirus crisis. And we're going to talk a lot about that. But as Sophie just explained, it doesn't really change the larger arc of conscious eating. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I'd love to hear from listeners about what you think are some creative approaches you're taking to pulling this off right now. So give us a call, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. people, you know, we've heard about the grocery stores being wiped out, certain sections, for some reason, bread, which is it's kind of interesting, and flour. There is apparently this, I mean, I've been wondering about why that is. And I wonder, there's just sort of this big link we have with wheat and bread and that and carbs.
Well, I think there's a lot to that, actually, to unpack, if we will. On the flour side, I think one thing we're seeing, and this may be a silver lining, I'm certainly looking for silver linings, not at all minimizing the gravity of the situation, but in a lot of ways, people are cooking food and preparing their own food more than they've had to or wanted to or felt compelled to in the past. And it is really interesting to see baking. You know, this is actually something that has risen even after the 2016 election, rage baking as a way of sort of channeling your
right.
frustration and lack of control. And I think for baking, it's comfort for sure. Bread is one of our most fundamental foods. It can feed a lot of people. But I think there's also a little bit more time. Some people are finding it really sort of meditative just to knead the dough, to watch their starter, nurture the starter for sourdough, for instance. And it is really interesting the ways that folks are having that closer connection to food in a lot of ways, finding some comfort not only in the food itself, but in the making of food. There's very little sources, few sources of food available. And it's really interesting to hear, anecdotally at least, that a lot of folks who are so busy, where food can sometimes be an afterthought, now the way that we're withdrawn into our homes, the three meals a day is really anchoring the day and the structure of daily life for a lot of people. So it's interesting. And in a lot of ways, that underscores conscious eating more than anything, because I designed the book stuff that comes from the ground, stuff that comes from animals, stuff that comes from factories, and stuff that comes from restaurants. And that's meant to be in descending order of what to eat the most of, because by and large, we know that when you cook food or make food for yourself, baking included, it generally tends to be better for you. And that transparency, that direct connection to our food is one of the simplest ways to be a conscious eater now and well into the future.
You know, some people might say that, well, it already is a luxury, or even before the crisis, it was a luxury for some people who live in food deserts. You know, they don't have access to the food. The closest thing is the chicken place on the corner sort of a thing, or the McDonald's. That may actually be the better food than what they're going to get at the corner, convenience store where, there's very little fruit and vegetables. What about them?
Yes, this is when I said that over that three-part mental checklist, you, others, and the planet is really going to evolve over time, but individually based on how your own life changes. Does your life circumstances? Do you have children? Do you change jobs? Do you move cities? But also how the world changes. And so in this current crisis, the food insecurity issue, the population of those who are most vulnerable, especially children who rely on school meals for sometimes their only source of nutritious food per day in a given day. The elderly certainly are another incredibly vulnerable population. These groups deserve particular attention. Not that they didn't already. This triple threat, as it's called, of climate change, malnutrition or hunger, malnutrition slash hunger and obesity, has been a slow moving emergency that I think is now actually even more front of mind, top of mind for many of us. So absolutely, it's incredibly important that we be more vigilant as really to that point of the global community. These are our neighbors, our friends, our colleagues. And so there are some interesting, there's a map put out by the UC Berkeley Center on Belonging, the Belonging Center for Belonging and Othering. And it shows maps of the most food insecure populations, so that if you have time, if you have ways to contribute food through food pantries, really interesting to see some restaurants and food service operations are actually transitioning to community kitchens. Chef Jose Andres has been spearheading this effort as well to convert as much as possible, because you have the culinary staff, you have people who can make food, and there's all kinds of interesting ideas. Could we use school buses as the delivery infrastructure? Feeding America is, you know, one of our most important hunger relief organizations, and they are really ramping up efforts and sort of trying to galvanize sort of an army of volunteers around ensuring that everyone has access to healthy, nutritious food, especially now when a lot of those existing programs are not open.
The issue of healthy immune systems is super is on top of people's minds. People are looking at what makes me healthy right now. Can you talk about that?
Definitely. I think a lot of times we think about food as medicine in the long term, right? Like, okay, if I eat lots of fruits and vegetables, maybe I'll prevent disease down the road.
Yeah.
And it's much more of an immediate benefit we're looking for with food now. And that's largely the immune system, as you said. So some of the things that registered dietitians, the nutrition community will tell us are really helpful. First and foremost, lots of produce. Eat the rainbow is a refrain that I think is kind of a helpful way to think about it, because those brightly colored, you know, tomatoes, bell peppers, dark leafy greens, berries, in any form, by the way, frozen, dried, you know, it doesn't need to all be organic. If it's seasonal, that can be more affordable. Whatever, I always say that the best produce is the kind you eat. almost no one pre Corona was getting about 1 in 10 Americans eating enough fruit and vegetables compared to the recommendations. So now's a particularly good time to really focus on produce. And that's included in not only grocery shopping, but what you're getting at the to-go or takeout or delivery. Really focusing on the fruits and vegetables that have tons of vitamin C, but other vitamins and antioxidants that can help keep inflammation at bay and really, really keep our bodies nourished. There's also some research that suggests that the microbiome, this is our gut bacteria, the good bacteria that we want in our digestive systems, that having a really thriving, diverse community of microbes can help fend off disease as well in terms of immune system. So how do you have a healthy gut? There's two main ways. One is there's a hashtag, feed your gut, and that's through fiber-rich foods. Coincidentally, produce has lots of fiber, so that's a twofer. Mm-hmm. And it is considered like the fertilizer for your gut. The other way is through fermented foods. Those are actually the live cultures. Like if you eat yogurt, you'll see that on the container, right? But there are other fermented foods as well, such as, you know, kimchi, sauerkraut, kefir. So those are two examples. And then the other really important one is not only what we eat, but what we drink. Caffeine and any thinking about how what we're eating is going to affect our sleep is especially important right now. So thinking about alcohol intake, which can perhaps be helpful from a stress standpoint in the moment, for many folks that can disrupt sleep, and then added sugar as well can also be particularly disruptive to sleep if you're eating, you know, a big dessert right before you go to sleep. It also has been tied to inflammation. So those are a couple of examples, but I also think it's important that we think about not only feeding our bodies, but feeding our souls. And I think a lot of people are looking for comfort. We talked about bread a little bit. I think that's a big part about, it's not just nutrition. It's not just the immune system. So what is also going to make us feel, loved and feel good afterward too. So soups, tea, things of that nature.
Yeah, that's why I've been making a lot of soups. My guest is Sophie Egan. She is the author of a new book, How to Be a Conscious Eater, Making Food Choices That Are Good for You, Others, and the Planet. We'll continue our conversation. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And if you're out there listening and you have an idea for how to achieve this in these days, times and days, give us a call. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Food packaging is supposed to be more informative these days, but for many, it's just more confusing. New York Times contributor and author Sophie Egan's new book is titled How to Be a Conscious Eater, Making Food Choices That Are Good for You, Others, and the Planet. And she talks about that in the book. Sophie, once again, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
So what about that? I subscribe to the shop around, you know, the perimeter of the store kind of philosophy, and don't buy a lot of prepared foods. We did stock up on some, you know, spaghetti sauces, you know, marinaras and that kind of a thing for the virus. But it's amazing how complicated the food labels have gotten these days.
It is. And, you know, you're not alone. Certainly 8 in 10 Americans report being confused about what to eat. And that makes 2/3 of them doubt their choices. And that's actually really a big part of what drove me to write this book, was to try to empower everyone to have enough information, but navigate really with the kind of the prescription lenses to see straight and navigate that information overload and decision fatigue. Especially now that many of us are trying to get in and out of the store as quickly as possible, we don't want to spend 20 minutes, you know, reading the novel on each item, nor do we want to be touching the box for all that long. So it's, you know, especially important now to kind of simplify some of that. So, generally speaking, like you said, you know, if you're shopping the perimeter, I mean, by and large, the healthiest foods, as a general rule, not always, but as a general rule, don't even have any labels, right? They are the produce, for example, like we were just talking about. Mm-hmm. But there's lots and lots and lots of healthy foods that might get sort of dumped into the bucket of processed foods. And really, there's a spectrum of processed and packaged foods in terms of health. So looking for ingredient lists that where the first ingredient is the most important. So in general, you want to zoom past most of the words on a package. Most of the time, it's largely a billboard full of marketing and, you know, colorful icons and things like that that you can generally ignore. A lot of the terms are not regulated. And in the book, I have the whole section on which stickers, which kind of third-party certifications like organic and fair trade actually do have meaning. Mm-hmm. So it's not a blanket statement. But generally, you want to go straight for the two really boring black and white parts that are on the side or on the back, and that's the nutrition facts panel and the ingredients list. So ingredients, as I said, you know, the first ingredient really matters. And ideally, people are asking a lot about their pantries now. Ideally, those ingredients are ingredients you would have in your pantry. You know, do you have hydrolyzed soy protein isolate in your spice cabinet? Probably not. You know, it's not necessarily the case that the fewer ingredients, the better. Sometimes there's just a lot of herbs and spices. You know, think about a salsa. I actually want lots of different types of, you know, onion and jalapeno pepper and so forth. So short can be helpful too as an indicator, fewer ingredients, but it's not across the board. And then on the nutrition facts panel, you're really looking for keeping added sugar, sodium, saturated fat at bay. And then in terms of those other words, it's very, very tricky. And it's why, as I said, you know, it's helpful to know which third-party certifications have really rigorous auditing. You know, this is all about transparency in the end. We're looking to, it's our right to know what's in our food. Third-party certifiers are essentially the referees of the transparency and traceability game. So my suggestion, especially now, is if you want to find that out, is to do that homework ahead of time so that you, you know, online if possible, so that you can kind of identify some go-to foods that you know you, where you trust, you feel like they work for you on a nutrition and health standpoint, and then they're really enabling you to support other values that you may want to express through your food choices. It's the old adage of, you know, vote with your fork or vote with your grocery basket. So fair trade, for example, will enable you to support fair working conditions and fair wages. Organic enables you to support no pesticides, no synthetic pesticides, and better environmental practices, and so on and so forth.
Right. It used to be the good housekeeping seal of approval was all you needed, and now there's a little bit more work to do.
There is, and you know, and it's really frustrating, I think, for a lot of people. But one of the things I always like to emphasize is this is not, don't let imperfect be the enemy of the good. Okay, we're all learning, and it's a lifelong pursuit. It's not a aiming for perfection 100% of the time, and this shouldn't have to be a source of anxiety and stress. We have so much already going on. But a lot of the time, if you kind of do in the upfront investment in, all right, I just want to figure out which kind of bread do I like? Like, just tackle, you know, one item at a time if you're really starting out with this, kind of paying more attention to labels. And then you'll get into a groove where you find products that that work for you. You find easy recipes and so on. And I think it can be really overwhelming if you're trying to do this all at once, which is not at all the goal. But it's more of an intention, a mindset that you want to strive for that. And also really looking for ways, as we talked about a little bit earlier, that align with your budget as well, because there are absolutely constraints. So, organic, for example, on produce, many people cannot afford to buy organic all the time, even if they wanted to express that value, right? So there are lists from the Environmental Working Group, the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15, for example, that are kind of the 12 produce items where pesticides are the most concerning and 15 where they're less concerning. Those shorthands can help you make those trade-offs. I like to emphasize, too, if you want to buy wild salmon, for example, frozen is a great option. Same with organic produce. Frozen is a great option. And speaking of pantry, lasts a long time.
Right.
So there are lots of ways to sort of find the balance that works for your family and your household.
As far as non-organic produce goes, so organic, you still have to wash it because someone's touched it, particularly in this day and age, right? And you don't know how it's been necessarily taken care of on that score.
Definitely. It's ever more important to be washing your produce right now.
And for a lot of people, they look at organic and they wonder, why am I paying for something that looks so ugly? I mean, that's part of the trade-off. You're not insecticide to death. You know, it's not going to be a perfect banana because there are not chemicals on it.
Yeah, and the other thing there is that, you know, taking a step back, we have a food waste crisis globally and in the U.S. So in the U.S., we waste about 40% of food, and that's at that same time that 40 million Americans are going hungry. Mm-hmm. And if we just redistributed a third of the food that's wasted, we would feed all the hungry people. Now, this is pre-corona, so that number is probably a bit higher. That said, the point on the kind of perfection is that for a long time, there's been these standards in grocery stores and by distributors of these perfect little orbs that every fruit and vegetable has to meet these certain standards. And you'd be shocked how much is left on the farm because no one in the large scale purchasing, there isn't a market for it. So you're not only when you're buying the items that maybe look a little different, it's a lot of it is culture shift over time of what we expect the produce to look like. Mm-hmm. If we're accustomed to them being the perfect, you know, Christmas ornaments in the bunch pile of uniformity and so on, then what we expect it to look like is going to be different. But on the flip side, I would say a lot of people find that sometimes the foods taste better. Mm-hmm. There's unclear yet on the data in terms of like, is it more nutritious? I wouldn't worry about that. But I do think it's helpful to get over the idea that it has to be, you know, no blemishes. And actually instead look for ways to embrace, you know, there's a great movement of ugly produce, imperfect produce. There are even CSAs, community supported agriculture, delivery boxes that only source those less attractive ones. So if that really, you know, jives with you, then I think that's a great way to both enjoy a great diversity of types of produce. It may be grown organically, but also it's helping avoid waste.
614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question or comment. We're talking about conscious eating. And my guest is Sophie Egan. She's author of a new book. It's titled How to Be a Conscious Eater, Making Food Choices That Are Good for You, Others, and the Planet. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Dick in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Dick.
There was some commentary about simple foods. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite foods has got three ingredients on the label. Wheat, canola oil, salt. No butylated nothing.
Simple's good.
Yeah, is that a cracker?
What is it?
It's a particular kind of cracker.
Okay. I love it. That sounds perfect. You know, that reminds me, that's a great example of, it's also specific to the product. So like, one of the most surprising things to me is when I see peanut butter that has like four ingredients, and you might think, oh, four, that's a small number. There should basically be one ingredient in peanut butter, peanuts, right? And half the time you say, well, is that a large or a small number? And I think it does, the context matters. And so that's where getting that, I love the listener's example because who wouldn't want a cracker that tastes delicious? And that's all that's in it, is simple ingredients that you recognize.
Thank you, Dick, for that call. Let's see, Mary in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have developed a whole bunch of more sustainable ideas because of this that I wish I'd done years ago. Number one, I'm using cloth napkins instead of paper. Mm-hmm. I happen to have bar mops, so I just laundered those, and I'm using them. Number two, if I'm not disinfecting the counter, I also now use and have for a while cloth towel to wipe it down. In order to have it hang and not get bacteria, I ordered a bunch of plastic banana hangers online, well, a few actually, and they're very cheap and save you from hanging towel racks. Number four, if I drop food on the floor, instead of grabbing a paper towel, I would first clean it to start with a page from an old magazine, and then maybe use just a quarter of a napkin to clean it up. And also, when I don't have enough gloves, to open outside doors, by the way, I use those old magazine pages that would have been recycled to open doors. So those are my thoughts.
You know, I thank you, Mary, for that. I've been using cloth napkins for probably 30 years, and a lot of people think it's because I'm fancy. It's not. I mean, it's to avoid paper napkins. I use them all the time and get them as messy as possible, and they're all worn out and ugly looking now. But yeah, what did you think?
That's,
I mean, Mary's got
amazing.
A lot of great ideas. Yeah,
Mary, those are great. And you know, this is exactly where I was heading with my earlier comment about my hope of some silver lining. You know, that that we're actually having. It's the great saying that necessity is the mother of invention, right? We're learning things we didn't have prior reason to look at from a different angle or to think of in the first place, with some new creativity being breeded. Another example of that is beans. Beans are having a
comeback,
bonanza,
yeah.
Right? And beans are sort of unsexy, but they are by far one of the most perfect examples, you know, all legumes really. That's, you know, chickpeas, lentils, the whole bean family, peanuts are actually a legume. All of those are at the intersection of what's good for you, others in the planet. They're super healthy, super fiber rich, really affordable, versatile, fit with almost any type of cuisine and flavor profile. So you can do tons of different things with them. They are the lowest environmentally intensive source of protein that you can possibly get. And then they're actually, in the case of a lot of legumes, they're actually nitrogen fixers. That means they improve the soil and can be used in crop rotation with other crops. So there's like these environmental superheroes that are super healthy. And it's just great that they're, you know, they've been kind of ignored in the grocery shelves mm-hmm. for all this time. So that I do look for some of those bright spots. And thank you, Mary, for those examples. What you also touched on is a great reminder of kind of a general philosophy that's, I think, taking more hold now. People may not know the term, but it's this concept of circularity. People are saying, you know, sustainability, kind of minimizing waste is not enough. We actually need to go a step further. And what by that, I mean, keeping materials in use longer. So the old waste, reduce, reuse, recycle. But cloth is a good example. You're 30 years there, and I mean, that's fantastic because it's all that time that those fibers were kept in use. And anything you can do, not only from a mindset standpoint of reusability, as well as just usability as long as possible, preventing that waste stream wherever it's going from occurring as soon as you can. As long as you can.
Right. Mary, thank you for that call. Let's see. Doug in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Doug.
Hi. I've really enjoyed listening to this program while I've been working out on my elliptical. I'm a recently retired gastroenterologist and have some comments. Number one, remember with diet, if you're eating one thing, you're not eating something else. So when you eat this healthful diet, you're excluding stuff that you shouldn't eat. And I think there's a fair amount of evidence that things like sugar and refined flour are pro-inflammatory. And you said that there aren't pesticides with organic food, but of course there are. But they're organic pesticides.
Right, right.
If you came in contact with them, they can kill you. But the thing is that they break down very quickly. You don't have forever chemicals on those. Mm. I think there is some evidence that if a woman is trying to get pregnant, that organic food is better. You're more likely to get pregnant if you're eating organic produce. The other thing is that I think that one trick I used to use, I'm a retired gastroenterologist, was I would send patients, or bring patients actually, to the supermarket and tour the facility with the dietitian in the larger supermarkets like Giant Eagle and Kroger. And they can explain to you how you can live on the cheap. And if you eat avocados, that's very expensive. You eat apples in season, it can be quite inexpensive. And finally, I think that there's a new medication that's supposed to help people lose weight. What it does is it expands in your stomach to make you feel full. You can do the same thing with lettuce. It's mostly non-nutritive. And I personally do that. I have two very large salads with lunch and dinner, and I've cooked vegetables with lunch and dinner and fruit with every meal. And it fills you up, and enabled me to lose 30 pounds and not regain it over 10 years. And it's not painful. I'm not hungry. So I think that using these strategies can help you be healthier, save your money. I will say one thing. I think emulsifiers, which are one of the last ingredients on the package, have been shown to be deleterious. They tend to damage the intestinal
gut.
What
are they for?
They're to make things smooth. Like if you make ice cream without alginate, it'll tend to crystallize, so you won't like it. You'll put it in your ice cream cone, and you'll say, "Oh, this is awful." There are a lot of these things, less than things like that, and so they keep the texture pleasing. But I think they're bad for you. I personally think that they should. I'd be careful about buying those things. I generally recommend it to my patients: don't get things on, just like your guests. Don't get things in a box to read the ingredients. Just get stuff from the produce. Whenever that's possible, I think that's great. But I think that as a society, we should be excluding these emulsifiers and get used to things that have ice crystals and things like that. I think that manufactured food, the hyper-manufactured food that we eat now is definitely bad for you. And remember, you are feeding the microbiome. There's evidence that if you eat a lot of sugar and flour, for instance, you get increased breakdown of sulfur, which increases the risk of colon cancer, for instance. And the way to counteract that is eat your fruits and vegetables and don't eat your flour, don't eat white bread. White bread recently introduced into the diet, 100 years ago. Before, there weren't efficient milling systems. So, when you grind wheat between two rocks, you don't really get much of the bran knocked off. So this is new. And this, if you look back on it, like in the early 20th century, mothers were giving their babies milk, giving them laxatives because they're all constipated. Well, nobody in the 19th century was constipated. They're all eating this high-fiber food. So it was only the introduction of manufactured food that resulted in this disease of civilization.
Wow. Well, definitely. Doug, thanks. Thanks for that call. Sophie Egan?
Yeah, definitely. Well, Doug, I certainly agree with you. Just across the board on many of those items that you shared. And I think it's a great opportunity to speak to the importance of whole grain. So when we were talking about baking earlier, it shouldn't necessarily be assumed that we're talking about making lots of, cupcakes with the, tons and tons of sugar and just refined flour. For me, not only has the quality of whole wheat flours, but a variety of other types of whole grain flours, it has really improved from a functionality standpoint. But there's also so much diversity to experience. Whole grains are incredibly important from a cancer prevention standpoint, as you just touched on, as well as preventing, they've been associated with lower risk of a wide range of other chronic diseases. They are, again, a source of fiber, which speaks to the microbiome that we talked about, just helps your digestive system stay on track. As was touched on, is really just a bummer from a nutritional standpoint, because the way that whole grain flours or that refined flours are made is that they siphon off the two most nutritious parts of a grain kernel, the germ and the bran. And if you really want to think about it, that's a huge source of food waste in itself. Often it's just fed to animals. So milling at home is gaining a little bit of traction too. It's a great, there are home mills you can buy. You can get it fresh is also from a flavor standpoint if you are baking. And it's a way you can ensure that all three parts are kept in the flour. There's also a lot of great movement occurring around local grain economies and supporting, choosing the grains that grow in your area. Depends on where you are, but from Colorado to Northern California, Washington State, the bread lab there, they have they're working with breeders, bakers, and millers to really do some exciting work for breeding wheat for flavor. Mm. So often we think of bread as just the vehicle for other flavor, like jam, but actually there's a huge variety of wheats and grains that are whole, that are good for us, that actually have incredibly delicious flavors in themselves.
We will continue our conversation with Sophie Egan. Thanks to Doug for that great call. Sophie Egan is the author of a new book. It's titled How to Be a Conscious Eater, Making Food Choices That Are Good for You, Others, and the Planet. And it's never been more important than right now where we're dealing with this other kind of externalized crisis that's affecting everything, including how we eat. So if you have a question or comment, you have an idea, a way you're approaching this challenge in these times, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about conscious eating, the idea that our food choices affect our health and the rest of the world. Still with us is Sophie Egan, a Stanford lecturer, New York Times contributor, and author. Her new book is titled How to Be a Conscious Eater, Making Food Choices That Are Good for You, Others, and the Planet. Give us a call if you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I thought one of the things that Doug, the gastroenterologist that called earlier, Sophie, that he said was the sense of wanting to feel full, and that we actually have a drug now, which, you know, I'm not going to pass judgment on it per se, that makes you feel full. It's a way to diet or to lower the number of calories you consume. But that you can do that in a really healthful way by just eating more salads, eating more vegetables.
That's right. And in general, I know we're giving a lot of airtime to fiber, but again, fiber actually has the same effect of filling, expanding in your stomach and making you feel full, which is a great additional plug for all kinds of produce, not just salads, but beans and other legumes also have that effect. As do whole grains, as we've touched on. But there are a lot of other examples, too, that can help with satiety, you know, which is that feeling of fullness. Staying hydrated is another great way. If you ever notice, if you are right before dinner time, if you just drink a glass of water, it kind of makes you feel full for a little bit. Tea and, you know, other beverages that are zero calorie and no added sugar, that especially now it's really important to stay hydrated for our immune systems, but at the same time can help us eat, help fend off hunger. I think the other thing, though, of course, is that it's not just about, you know, willpower.
Yeah.
Having a public health background, we have to keep in mind the broader context of our food environments that really cue a lot of the way that we eat. My first book, Devoured, is all about this, our American food culture, and the way that, you know, yes, individuals can do things on their own, but in general, we need a food supply and a system and a culture that through everything from access, as we've touched on, to just having time to eat in ways that enable us to be healthy and live long, high quality lives. For example, in schools, when schools reopen, one of the big issues is that there's not enough time in schools for kids to eat in a way that they that don't get stomach aches. You know, often 17 minutes for school lunch, and then it's back to all the other things. So there's also some cultural and policy measures that would really go a much longer way in addressing that obesity crisis.
Let's see. Destiny in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Destiny.
Hi, how are you doing, Ann?
Fine, thanks.
Excellent. I was calling because I was listening to the show, and I was hearing you guys talk about how some of the fruits and vegetables are thrown away that don't look so nice to the normal marketer. I was recently introduced to the idea of Misfit Market, and I just wanted to know if the author had anything about companies like that take products that are misfit looking, and they do ship them, and they use, they are locally sourced usually from farmers in the neighborhood.
Well, that's a really great idea. You know, there's a at the farmer's market, there's a couple different growers that always have a box of the misfit or like the less attractive fruit that I love to buy. What do you make of that, Sophie Egan?
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned Misfits Market, because that's exactly, you know, it really depends on the location around the country. There's different programs. So if that one is available in your area, that's terrific. But that's exactly what I was, had in mind when I was suggesting the imperfect produce boxes or ugly produce. And it's really important, too, that you touched on farmers markets. So definitely, I support that wholeheartedly, especially though the fact that not only is it misfits and addressing waste, but the more direct-to-consumer types of purchasing, the better in these times. In many cases, it's not, again, there's nuance with everything.
Right.
But the reason I say that is that farmers are really vulnerable right now because so many of their existing distribution channels are cut off. So school meals are closed. Many institutions like colleges and universities, corporate feeding programs, right? A lot of employers offer food. Those are closed. Restaurants are closed. Many, not only just the farm to table, but, you know, we've had a huge success over as a country in supporting local and regional agriculture, and our farm families really need ways to get to us. You also have the issue that although eating is essential and grocery stores remain open in many places, it really varies by location whether or not farmers markets are remaining open.
Right.
Because they're sort of in a gray area of, you know, community event space. And that, again, is a go-to critical source of income for those farmers. So especially finding ways to support food waste reduction through these CSAs and others. But just think about other ways that you can try to allocate your grocery dollars for those direct sources of income for our farmers, local farmers and small scale.
That's right. We're coming into farmers market. You know, usually a heyday for me is I love the farmers markets, and the Worthington market has some kind of deal set up now. I'm not quite sure what it is, where they can, like, I don't know, it's some kind of direct to farmer thing. So I'm going to check that out, and everybody else should too, because we're so lucky to have all the great farmers markets that we do around Columbus. But who knows what's going to happen to them this year? We'll have to stand by for that. Kent in Ashland, you're on the air. Hi, Kent.
Oh, is this Ian?
It's Ian, yeah.
Oh, hey.
Hey.
Hey, this lady seems real knowledgeable about greens and stuff. Now, I know different people that are, gluten gives them a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't eat gluten. And I've even heard of a gluten-free store starting to open. I just wanted to hear what she had to say about gluten.
Sophie,
I don't know much about it.
Yeah.
Sure. I have lots to say about gluten. I've written about this quite a bit. So your caller's absolutely right. Some people do absolutely have an issue with gluten. So the numbers are that about 1% of Americans have celiac disease. That's a serious autoimmune disorder. And those people are advised to strictly follow a gluten-free diet. It's incredibly important from a medical standpoint. Then there's about 6% of Americans that have non-celiac gluten sensitivity. So this is a milder condition that's more tied to digestive problems and symptoms that actually don't result in a positive test for celiac disease. Then you have a much larger number. Recent estimates have been as high as a third of Americans who are avoiding gluten out of sort of self-diagnosis of, I feel better. Now, there's been a lot of books that have popularized gluten-free diets. By and large, the point is that there are, for those people in the first category, the 1% with celiac disease, 100% important for those individuals to follow a strict gluten-free diet. Those with the sensitivities, it's a little bit less clear. But the rest of the population that's avoiding gluten purely because of concerns that, purely because it sort of is a fad and is popular, there's really no evidence that eating a gluten-free diet will help the majority of people. There even are some unintended risks, like not eating whole grains. A lot of times people going on a gluten-free diet don't eat any grains or eschew carbs altogether. And as we just talked about, whole grains are really, really important and super healthy for most people. there's also the health halo effect. When we see gluten-free on a product, just psychologically, most of us think that means it's healthier. And actually, there's been some studies that show that there's more sugar and salt in a lot of those replacement products, because you have to replace, to the great gastroenterologist point, whenever you're eating one thing, it means not eating another. Mm-hmm. Same with food manufacturing. When you're taking out something in a product, a processed product, you have to replace it with something. And the replacement ingredients in a lot of gluten-free products are either equally concerning from a nutrition standpoint, or sometimes are actually worse, just junk fillers and starches, you know, refined starches. So just the bottom line is, talk to your doctor before going on a gluten-free diet, and you know, be aware of the cons in addition to the pros. And then the great news is that the Whole Grains Council, if you are in need of a gluten-free diet, there are still lots of inherently gluten-free whole grains. So by no stretch does it mean that you can't enjoy it. You know, sorghum is an example. Quinoa is another example.
Kent, thanks for that call. I appreciate it. You know, something, it's all about me, Sophie. Something I really love, for not getting any more calls, I love eggs. I'm a huge egg lover. And now, because of that, I've gotten to where I prefer to get the eggs from my farmer's market whenever, you know, and I was starting to do that really regularly. And now, of course, they put the kibosh on that. So one thing I'm concerned about is it worth it, or is it not worth the carbon footprint of going to my provider, egg providers, directly? That, and then all these labeling issues on the cartons of eggs at the grocery store, cage-free. What does all of that mean now in reality?
Great question. Well, first of all, I think your suggestion of going straight to egg producers, getting them at your farmer's market, not only can that be a great way to support your local farmers, as we've talked about, but you probably have enjoyed the taste more, right?
Yes.
The big, you know, refrain also of know your farmer, know your food, goes a long way, because you can talk to them. You can ask them, how do they raise their chickens, you know, their hen? Can you even tour the hen house and see for yourself? And that's a great way to get up close and personal and really feel assured. So as far as the carbon footprint, it's local and regional sourcing have gained a lot of traction for all kinds of reasons. Environmentally, people are often surprised to learn that the distance traveled of a product is a small fraction of the total carbon footprint of a food. So it really matters much more just in general in the food supply. So I can't tell you exactly how far
egg
producer is from your house, but as a general rule. So I would say, if that is a way for you to access those eggs now, by all means. But in the grocery store or in, and it's important too to keep in mind, not just going to big box stores, but thinking also of supporting small businesses. So small grocers not only need, you know, small businesses need our help more than ever, but often they're actually better stocked right now, people are finding. So the other thing on the labels that you asked about, what does it all mean? Bottom line is, it's very confusing. I have a whole breakdown in the book on what they mean. But cage-free means that the animals were confined, but at least not in cages.
Okay.
So this is most important with eggs. Broilers, by the way, are not typically raised in cages. But cage-free does not mean that you necessarily go outside. Free-range means they go outside, but it might be a very small space, and it might only be accessible to some of the hens in a giant hen house. So pasture-raised is it goes in ascending order. Pasture-raised is the most room to roam. They likely have the ability to forage. But really what you want to do to make sure that there's real meaning behind any of those three terms is to look for a third-party certifier that actually has gone and checked that those practices are in place, because as standalone, those three terms don't have any backing. So animal welfare approved, certified humane raised and handled, GAP certified is a little bit niche right now for eggs, but is gaining in prominence. So I would check for those extra seals that mean someone went and really took a close look at the lives of the hens, assuming that does matter to you.
Sophie Egan, so much more to talk about. No more time at this point, but thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. Be well.
Sophie Egan, author of How to Be a Conscious Eater, Making Food Choices That Are Good for You, Others, and the Planet. Thanks to my all-site staff, most of whom are remote now, producer Aaron Esmont, producer Matt Rand. Allside's interns, Atiyah Turi, Bobby Gerberic, and Max Garrison, with video production by Nick Payne. Thanks to all of you for all your great work. And thanks to everybody else out there for listening. This is Allside with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.